Liaquat Ahmed is a veteran hedge fund manager who has now written a history of the years leading up to the crash of 1929. His book is called Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. Ahmed told Steve Paulson that the parallels between 1929 and our own time are striking.
Well, in both cases, we had a bubble. Then it was in the stock market. This time it was in real estate. In both cases, the bubble was caused by a mistake in Federal Reserve policy. In both cases, the mistake in Federal Reserve policy was associated with a malfunctioning of the international financial system. In both cases, the bubble eventually burst, as they always do. And in both cases, and this is the most important thing, the bursting bubble led to a banking crisis.
So how close did we come to another Great Depression?
Oh, in that crucial week in September last year, we came very close to a gigantic financial meltdown, which means that we could have had many large financial institutions having to close their doors.
You're saying 1 week was pivotal?
Yeah, 1 week was pivotal.
Remind me, what happened during that?
Well, there had been a sequence of institutions going under. So first in March, there was Bear Stearns. And it's like a set of dominoes falling, but except they started accelerating. Then in early September, there was two institutions, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We had a run on those. The government had to step in. Then we had the failure of Lehman Brothers, and the government decided to experiment and not step in. That was a big mistake, but not the most important mistake. They then had to bail out AIG the next day. The money market industry, which accounts for $3.5 trillion, which is like a bank, had a run. And something like 10%, no more, 20% of money market assets were withdrawn over that week.
So you're saying if the government hadn't stepped in and started bailing out these other institutions right after it didn't, Lehman Brothers, there would have been disaster.
Exactly. That said, there were a whole series of other things that the authorities have done, apart from protecting the banking system, which they didn't do during the Great Depression. So this time we bailed out the banks, that time they didn't. This time we cut interest rates to the bone. In the 20s, they didn't. In fact, at crucial points in the Great Depression, they actually raised interest rates. The third big element is during the Great Depression, they always thought that government budget deficits were always a bad thing. So in 1932, Hoover raised taxes to try and balance the budget, which is precisely the wrong thing to do in a depression. This time, every country around the world has allowed its budget deficit to expand by about 5% of GDP.
Okay, well, let's back the story up a few years. As you said, there was a big bubble before the Great Depression, a big housing bubble this time around. Lots of people warned that that bubble was going to burst. And yet it would seem that the people who really mattered, those who had some regulatory control, kept it going.
Yes. I mean, that's spot on. A lot of people thought there was a bubble, and a lot of people thought there would be terrible damage when it burst. Alan Greenspan, who was then chairman of the Fed, argued three things. One is, you can only tell whether something's a bubble ex post, that ex ante, it's hard to tell. So that's why he didn't want to do anything. Secondly, he argued that bubbles are a sort of inherent feature of the dynamism of capitalism, and that they're driven more by animal spirits than they are by credit policy. And thirdly, he argued that if he tried to prick the bubble, the side effects of the medicine would be worse than the disease, and far better to let the bubble burn itself out. Sorry for the mixed metaphor, and deal with the consequences afterwards. By the way, all three of those arguments were debated by the Fed in the 1920s.
And was Greenspan wrong on all three counts?
Greenspan was wrong on all three counts. And now there were a lot of people who agreed with him, including the current chairman, Ben Bernanke, who has now changed his mind. having witnessed the consequences of that policy. So they've essentially agreed that they have to deal with bubbles preemptively.
Hmm. Take me back to the late 1920s, the years right before the Great Depression. This is, of course, the subject of your book, Lords of Finance. And you make the point that there were a few men who really were pulling the strings, setting policy for really the global financial system, four men in particular.
Yes, I decided to tell the story of the lead up to the Great Depression by looking over the shoulders, if you like, of the four main central bankers of the world, the heads of the central bank of Britain, France, Germany, and the U.S.
And Britain had the most powerful bank at that point.
Exactly. I mean, Sterling was the linchpin of the world financial system. The Bank of England was the most important central bank. I think the virtue of telling the story through the lives and careers of these four men is it highlighted the fact that the Great Depression was not the result of sort of inexorable economic forces that people were powerless to resist. It was the result of a series of policy decisions which turned out to be blunders. And by focusing on some of the men involved, it was a way of highlighting the fact that it was the result of bad decisions by, if you like, well-meaning people.
Weren't these men considered the wise men of their day? I mean, brilliant people who were supposed to protect the world from what happened.
They were, and I suppose one of the morals of the whole story is that we know much less than we think we do about how the economy operates. And whenever you get a situation where you give a small group of men enormous power, which we continue to do, we give central bankers an enormous amount of power, you have to be very careful that they don't get seduced by their own dogmas.
Now, it wasn't one of their dogmas back in the 20s that sound monetary policy meant sticking with the gold standard?
Yes, exactly. And that was the dogma of the day. Somewhat understandably, people forget that 1929 occurred only 10 years after the First World War, the most disastrous war in history until then, which essentially bankrupted Europe. European governments were spending 50% of their GDP a year on fighting the war. They essentially destroyed their public finances, printed money to finance the war, caused inflation. So people thought the way to deal with this was to go back to the gold standard and impose the straitjacket. The problem was the straitjacket was way too tight.
So once the economy did start to melt down, did these four men have answers?
Well, just to give you an example, central banks could only print money equivalent to the amount of gold they held in their vaults. Now, when you started getting a run on the banks in 1930, essentially in 1930 and 31, a lot of gold was withdrawn from banks. As a consequence, there was a scramble for gold. And the first place where the scramble for gold hit was Germany. So in the middle of the Great Depression, with unemployment in Germany at about 15%, Germany, in order to hang on to its gold, was forced to raise interest rates from 4% to 14%.
Is it fair to say, focusing on Germany for a moment, that we cannot explain the rise of Hitler and the Nazis without the Great Depression?
In 1928, they had an election. The Nazis won 2% of the vote and had 12 seats. 3 years later, they had another election. The Nazis were the second largest party and won 25% of the vote. Within another year, they won 37% of the vote. So if you had to think of just one single thing to explain the rise of Nazism, it is the Great Depression.
Now, the man who is usually considered the great visionary of monetary policy back in, well, in response to the Great Depression was John Maynard Keynes. Did he have any power back in the 20s leading up to this time?
He didn't, in fact, but that didn't stop him. He was an economics don, sort of a professor at Cambridge, but he was also a journalist, he was a private investor, and he was a gadfly, if you like, and he would write articles in the papers. It's a little bit like Paul Krugman does now.
Of course, Keynes is the great hero of Paul Krugman.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, when I interviewed Krugman not that long ago, he said, what we need more than anything right now is another John Maynard Keynes.
Right. He figures very prominently in my book because he's, if you like, the hero, and he's the fifth man who acts as this Cassandra talking from the wings, and like Cassandra, no one listened to him.
So what were his great insights that these four power brokers earlier, back in the late 20s, just didn't get?
I suppose three things. One is that the overhang of debts after the First World War, Britain and France imposed a large fine on Germany, reparations, and they did it largely because they owed an enormous amount of money to the U.S. And Keynes pushed for the U.S. to forgive these war debts because he argued that this would, if you like, just get rid of this overhang of debts. Secondly, he called the gold standard a barbarous relic. He thought it was absurd that we had tied ourselves to this metal and that central bankers were determining the amount of credit they provided to the economy based on how much gold was mined out of the earth. It just made no sense to him. And thirdly, he argued that once the Great Depression started, or once the Depression started, the policy of trying to cut budget deficits was self-defeating, that it would drive the economy further into a depression, and that living temporarily with deficits was a much better solution.
So actually the solution is to spend more money.
Yep.
To stimulate the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the paradoxes that we got ourselves then and we got ourselves this time into a terrible economic situation by borrowing too much money, and that the solution should be to borrow more money.
Now, we've been talking about the sense that there were these wise men, these few men who really understood the world's economy better than anyone else. And that kind of thinking seems to continue to this day. You cite at the end of your book a cover story in Time magazine in 1999, the Committee to Save the World, which mentioned three men, Alan Greenspan, then head of the Fed, along with Robert Rubin and Larry Summers in Clinton's Treasury Department. And these were the guys who were widely hailed as heroes, the ones who, at least at that point, saved the economy.
Yeah. I mean, in 1998, this cover story from Time magazine ran, I think, actually in early 1999. And they did save the world in 1998-99 by essentially stepping in when a run started on the Asian economies. And I suppose that led to a sort of certain amount of hubris. They felt that we know exactly what levers to pull when to stabilize the economy. And it created, one, a sense of overconfidence, which then fed back to private investors who said, well, these guys will always bail us out.
So is there a better way to do this? Isn't this just likely to happen again some years down the road?
There clearly is a better way than we've done up to now. I'm not sure we will eliminate all bubbles, all future crises. We can clearly do a better job in reducing the probabilities that they will occur. The incredible thing that happened last year was not subprime mortgages. Bankers are always making bad loans and end up losing money. That's always going to happen. The total losses on subprime mortgages was about, I don't know, $400, $500 billion. The really astounding thing was that a loss of that magnitude, which sounds large but is actually quite small compared to the whole world's financial system, should cause the Western financial system to collapse. So it was not so much subprime as much as having an incredibly fragile financial system. And it was incredibly fragile because it was too leveraged, that we allowed institutions to do things without having enough capital. And so when they started facing severe losses, their depositors and their creditors started panicking and taking money out. And the solution, I think, is very simple, which is we've got to build up more capital. That's what the Geithner Financial Regulation Plan involves. The crucial, the $64 trillion question is how much capital is the right amount? It's like having speed limits on the highway. You know, we know that we need speed limits. We clearly can't have speed limits of 40 miles an hour because no one would get anywhere. But on the other hand, we don't want to have no speed limits. So the trick is to get the balance right.
Liaquat Ahmed talked with Steve Paulson. Ahmed is a longtime hedge fund manager and the author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World.
The best things in life are free.